C1M, number 14B.
Having come to the ninth touchstone of truth in life, see, up to now we have seen the six subjects as being that in the measure as we begin to understand the higher nature of man, namely that man which is God's man. But in the measure as we begin to understand the higher nature of man, that is the Christ, the liberator to the mortal sense of man. That it liberates first in the subzone of mind, that mind liberates us from the belief that we have to care for the human body. There he says, let the divine mind care for the human body, and let no mortal erring concept interfere with God's government. So that as we understand the higher nature of man in the subzone of spirit, that we begin to realize that only the good, the spiritual, the pure, the fine is really our origin, and that we have been born and unfolded and developed and generated out of the spiritual good. And then we begin to see in the subtone of soul that then therefore there is no distinction between the two sexes. And something new is being born in us, that we regard all people as equal, and therefore also stand for the equality of men, and therefore stand for legislation which equalizes the sexes. Then in the subject of principle, to a higher understanding, a better understanding of man's higher nature, we begin to wed ourselves more and more to all men, not only to one man, that we broaden out and see the generic sense of man, that we are wedded to all men, and are there to help all men, to be there for the support of all men. And that brings us now to the subject of life, where she shows that in this understanding, therefore, we begin to support and uphold all that is for the good of mankind. That we are not permit a disregard of law which leads to a worse state of society. We just can't anymore then not support everything which is helping mankind, be it in legislation, be it in economics, be it in sociology, be it in medicine, be it in whatever field it is. We will be supporting that which has an upward trend. And then she shows in the subzone of truth a very nice thing, namely that by welcoming truth, the Christ, that by welcoming that Christ truth, the humanhood is transformed into spiritual manhood, that the water will be turned into wine. That therefore, as he says, the bridal altar really is not an occasion to legalize sex, but that it is an occasion to remind ourselves of the turning of the water into wine, which Jesus presented at the marriage feast. That it is showing us that in the measure as our understanding of the higher nature of man, and not the knowledge of the mortal, but an understanding of the higher nature of man, that has a Christ power. That has a Christ power, namely it begins to turn the water into wine. It begins to give to the human life an inspiration by which man's spiritual existence can be discerned, he says. It is that where she says that human happiness should proceed from man's highest nature. She shows here that in the measure as we fulfill through the five first substones a higher understanding of man's nature, that that becomes the Christ to us, that that begins to dictate human happiness, that that begins to dictate what is going on in consciousness, and that it dictates in this way that we awake to see always clearer and clearer and clearer what is true manhood. That's the beauty of it. See, so often we feel, well, how can I get a better understanding of the spiritual fact? How can I get that? And always when she comes to the throne of truth, she shows it. Namely, she shows that through keeping the demands of mind and spirit and soul and principle and life, through keeping that, we are newborn. That through obedience to mind and spirit and soul and principle and the life propositions, that through that, something in us is being newly born, reborn, and I become a new man. Christ then turns the water into wine. Christ then turns our indefinite thinking, our tentative thinking and feeling into clear, inspired, definite understanding. That's a process that goes on which nobody can explain. It's a divine fact. It cannot be explained humanly. It's a divine fact. It's a divine operation. All what we can is to see the law ruling this process. Just as we can't see electricity, but we can know the laws and the rules in order to tame or to use electricity. And so it is with the Christ. And as this is going on, she comes to the last subtone of love, where she says that the more metaphysical our foundation in understanding is, the more manhood is attained. That's really the point, you see. That if we regard life more metaphysically, then we are more men. If we regard life always and always humanly, being bound to persons and personal sense, being bound to all sorts of human propositions, we will never be man. Only as we wed ourselves to a pure metaphysical understanding of God, God is the Christ to the situation, lifts us out of a narrow sense of relationship. And so here we have that last stone. Let me come to the next question, 37. The question where we always ask ourselves, in order to see the coherency of the text, we ask ourselves, what is the connection between the chapters? And here, what is the connection between the six subjects in prayer and the six subjects in atonement and Eucharist and the six subjects in marriage? Because we know that if this textbook is ordered, that we can't start just in the middle of the textbook. We just can't start just with marriage. If we would just start with marriage, the whole thing would be a mental, moral effort. But we must see that our source is always in God. And so let us see how we arrive at this big subject. So I compare, as I have last time, I think you remember, I compared every subject of the first five with the first five of prayer and atonement and Eucharist. The sixth subject, how do we get there? Now, what was it in prayer? In prayer, we had the proposition that by affirming God, prayer of affirmation, that by affirming God, we shut out sinful sense and thereby establish truth. That was the prayer. The prayer of the sixth prayer was the prayer of affirmation, of affirming God. And through affirming God, we shut out error and therefore establish truth. But then we came to atonement in Eucharist, and we saw there that this affirmation of God has demands which says, all right, then let go in your consciousness the false sense of God and name. Be willing. The chaplain of atonement in Eucharist is always saying, be willing to sacrifice something false. Therefore, be willing to sacrifice the false sense of God and man. False sense of God and man. Even if that man is a husband or a wife or a child or whatever it is. Let go the false sense of man. And then, in that measure, as we are willing to let go, then we saw there in that sixth subject how a new sense of man, the new birth, is taking place in every detail. Remember, it was that subject where Mrs. Eddy presented Jesus chronologically, Jesus' life story chronologically, from the point of conception to ascension, where we showed that in the measure as we let go a false sense of God and man, and we accept really, affirm really that prayer sense, that God is the creator of all, that brings out in us the birth of the new man or every deed. Well, in the measure as we are willing to let go of the false sense of God and man, and in that measure that the new sense of man is being born, is waking up in us and is putting forth its divine claims, in that measure, naturally, I begin to feel that something takes place in me, which is of the nature of a better man. Of a better man, and the more, therefore, I wend myself to atonement and Eucharist to a better sense of God and man, the more I begin to express a higher standard of manhood. That's merit. I begin to express and to manifest a higher sense of humanhood. Manhood and humanhood. Here where I am, I bring more and more a diviner sense of God and man into my life and into my actions. And so I bring out the higher ideal, and in this way I contribute to elevate society. You see, therefore, I can never be a contributing factor to a better manhood, to a higher sense of manhood, to a higher ideal of mankind, until through prayer and atonement I have gained a higher sense of God, and through a higher sense of God I have been willing to sacrifice the false sense of God and man. That must go before. But the tendency of the human mind is always to go into heaven without dropping everything that is unlike God. So I can see that the more I am one with truth through what I have known in prayer and atonement and Eucharist, the more I become one with truth, the more I begin to embody. That's now the marriage chapter. The more I begin to embody really the nature of man, a higher nature of man, a higher ideal of man, and the more I begin to redeem mankind from a false sense of manhood. And the more, therefore, I contribute to a higher society, to a higher sense of society and of the standard of manhood. Well, the time is getting on, and I just don't get on. I think I will take the seventh subject a bit quicker. It's a pity, but it's because it's a very nice subject. So let's come to the seventh subject. What did we see last time in the seventh subject? In the seventh subject now, I get the climax of this step by step evolution in the marriage chapter. Namely, there where a new quality and a higher quality is asked to be fulfilled, namely the quality of spiritual adherence. Now, that's how I worded it. You may have worded it a bit different, but what she asked here is, just to try to describe it, is that now she says, all right, if in the sixth subject we have seen that it is the higher nature, the understanding of the higher nature of man which matters, and not the mortal, that the higher nature of man is really the savior for the mortal concept of man, then naturally the conclusion is, which he proposes here at the seventh subject, that he says, therefore, all what you need to do is to stick to the spiritual, claim the spiritual, adhere to the spiritual, demand for the spiritual. The spiritual is the ultimate. And perhaps you have noticed how often in this seventh subject Mrs. Eddy brings in the term spiritual, which she hasn't done very often before in the chapter. The human now must yield to the spiritual. That's the climax of marriage. The climax of marriage is where the concessions must yield to the spiritual ultimate. And she shows how she uses terms like this as qualities which are demands. She says it demands a more spiritual adherence. She demands here spiritual ascendancy. Before it was only the ascendancy of good over evil. Now it's spiritual ascendancy. This demands spiritual consciousness is needed. It is, we must spiritually understand that there is but one creator, and to educate spiritually. All these terms indicate the meaning now of the seventh subject. It shows now that what is demanded to come to the real marriage feast, to that marriage feast which she describes in the Apocalypse. And until then, she never uses again the term marriage in the textbook. She leaves it from here until the end of the text. Because it takes the whole textbook to come to that highest sense of marriage, which she presents as the marriage feast. The lamb, the bride wedded to the lamb. In that, here, in this attempt to reach to that point, she demands spiritual adherence, to reach out for the spiritual, to be willing to see and to recognize that the human is insufficient. That's the bitter pill in it. The pill which she here gives us in the seventh subject is that she shows that the human is insufficient. Shows that through the first five subjects, she has shown how we can improve the human and human relationships, how we can give to the human a better touch, a higher tone. Then she showed in the sixth subject, she showed, but after all, we have to reach out for man as God's man. And so now in the seventh subject says, therefore you must see that only in the spiritual is true harmony and true satisfaction. And it shows that in the human there is no satisfaction. That the human just can't be holy, good, holy, harmonious, holy, satisfactory. That only the spiritual can be satisfactory in every way. So we come to this seventh subject. It appeals to the reason and says, what is demanded of you is that you see the insufficiency of the human, and therefore that you reach out for a spiritual unity, a spiritual adherence. And that spiritual adherence will rise you higher. That's the effect of it, that it has always a sense of life and truth. It rises you higher. How high? And it says it rises you to that point where you perceive yourself that man is God creating. That's the highest point. Here she speaks about man coexisting with God, about man evolved from spirit, about man deathless, perfect, eternal. You see, we get here now the fulfilled state of man as God's man. How do we get there? Well, she says, we get there by seeing that the human is insufficient, and therefore by waking up and longing and reaching out for spiritual adherence. How does she show that? Through the subtone. And in short, she shows it like this. You remember how she begins to show that love is, we know that love is forceful. We know that love fundamentally is that which does everything, leaves no stone unturned, in order to bring man back to God, to draw man back to God, to bring man back to his primeval state of harmonious existence. And in order to do that, love uncovers the insufficiency of the human effort. It shows that no human effort, that even no human morale, has enough power to stabilize harmonious manhood. Here she begins and says that all through this insufficiency of the human, we begin to behold the powerlessness of human vows. And that through this powerlessness of human vows, seeing that they are not powerful, that under the stress of circumstance they break down, seeing that and beholding that, one awakes somehow to the fact that one says, then I must put my anchor into another realm, into the spiritual realm. I must anchor myself in the spiritual. And so, he says, then the human mind demands a higher affection. That's a wonderful process that's going on. He goes on and says, in the platform of spirit, he says, yes, but that passage where one is, how do you say it? That doesn't come, the term. Not deceived, this not disgusted. Disillusion, yes. Thank you very much. But in the measure as one is disillusioned about the moral code, about moral powers, about the powerlessness of the human, that insufficient and that disillusionment, that has something in itself which begins through love to talk to us and says, well, then turn to something which is more fundamental, which is more, which has greater stability, greater security, more permanency. And so it drives, really, us to awake and reach out for the spiritual. But in that process of disillusionment, She says that is a process of fermentation and chemicalization, which by itself is not very agreeable. But she shows that there is an angle behind it, that this process is fundamentally from love, because love wants us to wean ourselves away from all that is human and wrong and unbasic and not fundamental. And so even if there is a fermentation, if there is even a transitional stage which is disagreeable by itself, that brings in us a purification. Nothing purifies so much as when we are going through deep water. It purifies our motives, it purifies our aims, purposes, and so demands for a more spiritual adherence. And men find a more spiritual adherence, he says there. And in finding a more spiritual adherence, he comes to the next stage, the stage of Abraham, where she says, but stick to it. Stick to it for thin and thick. We say, I don't know if you have a...
Thick and thin.
Thick and thin. I'm longing for the day when you come to Zurich to give a talk on science for 4 hours. In German. Yes. Here she says, here comes that state of Abraham where love after, how is the definition of Abraham? It's the purpose of love to create trust in good, something like that. Well, love as soul here comes and says, well, and in that transitional stage where you go through deep waters, you must see the sense of soul, perseverance, of sticking, of waiting, and sticking, persevering, waiting, having patience, sticking, persevering, and so on, and so how often, until the situation clears, until either the wreck goes down or sunshine gladdens the heart. It's that wonderful period which so often we want to go around, to eschew. You say eschew. Escape, yes. Which one wants to escape. Because it is that transitional stage which seems to be filled with adversities, trials, sorrows, with tribulations, with storms. That's what she says. But she shows that through spiritual adherence and sticking to the spiritual and going through instead going around it, going through it, that is a period which is dictated by love, and that love makes out of those circumstances the biggest and highest blessing. That's what every one of us has to experience. Until we have not experienced that, we will not believe it, and it will not be real to us, and we will never enter into the holy. There is just no other way. The way is always to go through the Red Sea. And if we go through the Red Sea, the waters will divide. And we will walk on dry land. And the chariot of the Pharaoh will be drowned. But we must go through it. And if we don't have the courage to go through it, well, the chariot of the Pharaoh will kill us. Nothing is more antagonistic than to hold or to go back. We must go forward. And love asks us here to go forward and shows that that's what human sense calls adversity is in God's eye really sweetness. That's what human sense terms as ugly and venomous, as an ugly situation, God calls it a precious jewel. He says that really that which we call sorrow, God terms it salutary. But that which the human mind terms a great tribulation, God doesn't call it like that. God's naming, love's naming, love and soul. Love's naming is different, says, oh no, it is a means to enter into the kingdom. That which the human mind calls a trial is in God's eye, God's care. Trials are a proof of God's care. Or she shows that every decay of material health seems to us a catastrophe, but to God's sense, to God's spiritual sense, says it is a propagation of higher joys. That which seems to be a sanctity is really viewed from a divine point, or she says, a discipline for patience. And so she goes on and shows that that which seems to be a notion of sorrow is really in God's eye a definite decision in working out the harmony of being. So, again and again, though one knows these things, though we talk about these things, I know, the moment we come into tribulation and trials and sorrow and so on, we all forget it. But we don't. But little by little, as we ponder these things and we experience these things, as we take the opportunities to take these opportunities and make an experience out of it in the divine way, we begin to learn the sweetness of it and begin to learn the touch of love as soul. Love which says, I draw you to me. I draw you into the kingdom. I draw you to the realm of the signs of peace. But I can't draw you into that sea of harmony, into the realm of harmony, unless we are friends of things of life and the harmony, what should constitute the harmony of existence, and take on a spiritual sense of what constitutes the harmony of things. Only in that way, through soul translation, through soul cleansing way, can we enter the kingdom. That tone of love of soul takes about a page and a half. It's so long compared with the whole chapter that one begins to see that therein lies one of the clues for the whole chapter on marriage. For the whole question of how can I be happy in this world. To be happy in heaven, that's very easy to do. But to be happy and joyful in this world, to be happy and joyful in a world of tribulation, trials and sorrows and so on, how can I demonstrate that? And it's only by seeing the insufficiency of the human, only by seeing that all that can be hurt and all that can suffer is a human sense of things and a mortal sense of things, but never the divine sense of things. And so marriage asks us and says, well, those trials and tribulations and sorrows, they must occur because they have the power to make the human mind realize how vain the material and the human is. Until that happens, one doesn't see the vanity of the material and the human. And so we are not driven to the more spiritual appearance. Then she goes on in that vein and shows that through the trust of the principle, the love of principle, that through trust in the spiritual alone, spiritual power is made available. See, that only when we go through that sense of love of soul, only if we stick and persevere like Abraham and go through the wilderness, always go through the wilderness, never leaving the high goal out of sight, always having that wonderful promise that we will be led into the promised land, letting go to the right and to the left, the Harans and the Lot and all those, letting them go, but persevering and persevering to the high goal. But in doing that, that gives us spiritual power. He says that is that which gives us spiritual power. That grace and truth, that spiritual consciousness, that gives us spiritual power. Whereas all the other things, like animal natures, like the means and methods of the world, like the systems of religion and medicine, like fear of being thought ridiculous, like being a slave of fashion, pride and sense, and all that thing does give us no power, no spiritual power. Spiritual power of principle really is awakened in us as we go through mind, spirit, soul. Since we started with prayer, I made a point out of the order of the synonymous term. I made a point that we can't experience and have the qualities and the ideas of principle without going through the zone of mind and of spirit and of soul. And we can't experience life without going through the first four. And we can't experience truth, which always recapitulates all the seven, if we have not gone through the first five. And so, let us be clear that every one of us would like to have harmony. Every one of us would like to have spiritual power which demonstrates harmony in this world. But that is the tone of love as principle. Where is the tone in our life of love as mind, love as spirit, and love as soul? Where is the tone in us which awakens to behold in love as mind the insufficiency of the human? Where is that in us which beholds that the chemicalization and the fermentation is not something which is given by the devil or by error, but by love, which wants to purify us, and therefore that we accept this purification, this process of purification, and that we see that we only have in love a soul to go through the experience and stick it through and go it through and not halt and not go back and wait the issue. And the issue will always be according to our attitude. If our attitude has been in the way of spiritual perseverance, then always sunshine will gladden the heart. And that sense of development which we have gone through, that which we have cultured in that way of spiritual attraction, that gives us now in love as principle spiritual power to handle a situation, to be master of the situation. And so she says at the end of that paragraph, we should cherish nothing which hinders our highest selfhood. And that gives the bridge to the tone of love as light. Because that shows again that in the measure as we bind ourselves to the spiritual ultimate, that can no more suffer any restriction. In that tone of love as life, she shows the universality of individuality. Wonderful tone of love as life. You see, the universality of an individuality, that our individual nature is always individual, collective, and universal. And the moment somebody wants to make that individuality only individual and therefore bind it back to a single relationship and to a single bondage and to a single the single relationship, it goes against the universal sense of individuality. It breaks. Therefore, she says, before one binds oneself to a vow, let us be sure that we don't find our individuality back into something which is small, but that our individuality still remains and can remain universal. That consider its obligation, its responsibility, and its relations in relation to your growth, she says, and to your influence on other lives. This universal moment, something would find the fact that we are restricted and no more free to be bound to the universe, then we kill our individuality, and that can never be satisfactory. It's that which says, do the greatest good for the greatest number, because that suits your universal sense of individuality best.